Hello again, everyone. If everybody could take their seats, we will get started with today's first speaker. It's my pleasure to introduce Chase Carpenter. Chase is the Senior Director of Strategy and Analytics for the Chicago Cubs, where he leads the organization's predictive analytics efforts, focusing on ticket pricing, food, beverage, and event operations, and guest experience. Prior to joining the Cubs, he worked at RSG, a consulting company focused on product development and pricing strategy. He attended Dartmouth College for undergrad and competed on the men's baseball team all 4 years. He completed his MBA at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Here to give our welcome message today, Chase Carpenter.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Thank you, Scott, for the kind intro and not tracking down my stat line from college. Unlike the Cubs come from behind victory last night against Milwaukee, my stat line was pretty forgettable. In case you didn't know, and I saw this stat this morning, prior to last night, the Cubs had managed to lose 112 games in a row when we were down by two or more runs going into the ninth inning. I checked Fangraphs this morning. In the ninth inning, we had a 3% chance of winning that game, and then in somewhat spectacular fashion managed to pull off that victory. So, pretty excited to have broken that streak. I do think it's pretty fitting that on the eve and kicking off this conference that is about the dissemination and research around baseball, that we're still managing to create new statistics about the game. It is an honor to be here to spend some time with you this morning to welcome you to the city of Chicago, the Palmer House Hotel, and most importantly, Sabre 51. There's a packed agenda over the next several days exploring all the various nooks and crannies of the game of baseball, and I couldn't be more excited to kick that off with a deep dive into the Chicago Cubs organization. To help us get started, by a quick show of hands, who here either grew up in Chicago or lives in the Chicagoland area? Awesome. This is traveling crew. It's only maybe about 25-30% that are from here. So for those that didn't grow up here, and I consider myself a transplant from Memphis, Chicago loves its history, and some of that history is even true. In fact, this hotel and the Chicago Cubs have an interesting and overlapping origin story. Potter Palmer, the proprietor of this hotel, was also a founding member and team president for the Chicago White Stockings. That was the predecessor club behind the current day Chicago Cubs. This hotel was built in 1871, immediately before the Great Chicago Fire, and like most of the city, burned down, but was rebuilt and opened in 1873. They then continuously operated until the COVID-19 pandemic, earning themselves the moniker of longest continuously operating hotel in America. As I was doing my research for this talk, I came across at least two other hotels in the Boston area that made that exact same claim. They're not here, however, to defend themselves, so we're going to stick with my version of the story. Chicago White Stockings had an equally inauspicious start with a bunch of starts and stops. Their initial field, the Lakefront Park, which is now in modern-day Millennium Park, burned down in the Great Chicago Fire. Team ownership, the team name, all this stuff changed several times in the late 19th century, but by 1903, the team was commonly referred to as the Chicago Cubs. We won the World Series in 1907 and 1908. And then I think, as everyone knows, we had a decent drought until 2016 until we won the World Series again. We're going to dive into a little bit about what we did as an organization to make 2016 a reality. So this morning, to help kind of frame our conversation, we're going to hit on three things. First, there are two fundamental truths about sports business that I want to help lay the groundwork with. And second, I want to share with you our vision and mission as the Chicago Cubs. And then third, and probably most importantly, we're going to talk about how we took those words into action and how they've really been the guiding light and principle for our business since the Ricketts family acquired the team in 2009. Cool. All right, two truths about sports business. The first one, we call this the business and baseball flywheel. This is what directly links and ties the business side of our operations to the baseball side of the operations. You can start kind of anywhere you want on this flywheel. I'll start in the upper left corner. Strong, good team performance generally makes fans happier. That provides a better guest experience. I don't think that should be too controversial. Better guest experience generally leads to business growth as fans are more excited, more willing to invest more with a team that is winning, right? We all like to watch a winning team and a winning product. That business growth should funnel its way back to reinvestments into payroll and baseball operations, and then when executed well, those reinvestments lead to future team performance, sustained team performance, and over time, that flywheel becomes self-sustaining and a somewhat virtuous cycle. I'll be 100% transparent here. We're borrowing this work directly from the work of a notable business author named Jim Collins. He wrote a book named Good to Great, where he did a ton of research trying to understand what successful and unsuccessful businesses did. What separated those successful businesses from the ones that failed? After Jim's research, essentially what he found out and what he came to conclude is that successful businesses have a really refined and detailed understanding of what drives value and what doesn't. Not surprisingly, successful businesses find ways to reinvest significantly into those things that do drive value, and they stay away from things that don't. Take Amazon, for example, right? They had a strategy of offering low prices across a bunch of products in their catalog. That's pretty attractive to us as consumers because we like low prices and we like to be able to buy a lot of things in one spot. It's convenient. That strategy allowed them to attract more third parties who wanted to list their product on Amazon because it was more efficient for them. That allowed Amazon to expand their product portfolio, grow their revenues more than costs, further lower their prices, and they've been running that flywheel for two decades now. They've been running it really well to the tune of, you know, $1.4 trillion market cap company. For successful businesses, it's really hard to look back in retrospect and point to any one aha moment, because success is built over time with a bunch of small and medium-sized wins that eventually build on themselves, and like I said, eventually you can't look back and point to any one thing. For us, from the outside looking in, you may look at the 2016 World Series and say, oh, well, that's your aha moment. That's where success came from. But I think that kind of misses the point. The 2016 World Series was really the happy byproduct of a bunch of really hard work and smart decisions that the organization had made in the years leading up to that. And that gets us to second fundamental truth in baseball. Success is not linear. We certainly see this on the player development side, as most players spend years in the minor leagues before they matriculate to the major league roster, if you're afforded that opportunity at all, right? I would put myself in the category of people where the game did not afford me that opportunity. Given that, roster construction takes several years to put together. This is in somewhat stark contrast to other professional leagues, where two or three free agent signings, a couple good trades can completely overhaul the outlook and the prospect of an organization overnight. We'll see how things pan out, but the Blackhawks' recent signing of Connor Bedard likely fits into that category. I know they're excited as a front office, and I'm excited to see what he can do on the ice. On the business side, the most important thing we can do is to position the business to take advantage of strong periods of team performance, to maximize the highs, and then when team performance is not as strong, raise the floor for the business. In other words, minimize the lows, maximize the highs. And somewhat interestingly, when team performance is not as strong, that's actually when we want to make big investments for the future so that we can make those investments when team performance comes back, we're in a good position to capitalize on all those investments that we've made. That brings us to our vision and mission statement. Be unrivaled on and off the field. Frankly, we want to be the best at everything that we do. We want to outcompete our peers and our competitors. And to help drive that, we've articulated three distinct missions. The first one should be pretty obvious. We are a baseball team after all, and so winning the World Series is our primary goal, and success on the field is how we measure that. Right? We're very fortunate to have many generations of loyal Cubs fans, and our goal is to reward them with another World Series victory. Create the world's best guest experience. Wrigley Field is for everyone, right? It is called the Friendly Confines. We want to make unforgettable moments, form indelible memories, and create lifelong fans. We seek to continuously improve Wrigley Field and Sloan Park to exceed our guests' expectations. And then finally, be a good neighbor. For those of you who've been to Wrigley, it's quite literally in the middle of the Lakeview or the Wrigleyville neighborhood. It's the only professional sports stadium that is in a otherwise highly residential area. Our desire to be a good neighbor, however, extends beyond Wrigleyville, and we want to be active and present in all the communities where we work and play. You can see the five values in the bottom right corner around stewardship, team first, ambitious, inclusive, and friendly. I'm not going to spend a ton of time there, but we will come back to the first one in the form of stewardship a little bit later. If I take a step back, I am sure most professional sports teams have some version of this slide that sits hanging on their walls and in their various internal materials. I don't think anything here is terribly controversial or shattering. I do, however, think our organization has done a really good job of taking these words and translated those into action. To fully put the mission and vision into context, we need to understand a little bit more about the state of the franchise when the Ricketts family acquired the team in 2009. It would be a little challenging to do appropriate service to the history of the team between 1876 and 2009, but I want to hit a few of the highlights. Before 1920, primary focus, live events. That was really the only way to consume our product, to engage with us as a team. I mentioned the two World Series victories in 1907 and 1908. If you fast forward a little bit, Babe Ruth famously called a shot at Wrigley Field in 1932. It's one of the first replica cards I remember owning as a young kid. Right around that time, the Chicago Cubs were also credited with creating the concept of the season ticket. That credit really belongs to a lady named Margaret Donahue, one of the most successful female executives in all of baseball. If you have a chance to go visit Wrigley, I'd encourage you to walk a couple blocks west. We've built a park honoring the work that she did for the Chicago Cubs organization. Radio came along in 1921 and over-the-air TV in 1939. It's not until 1999 when cable TV came along in the form of Fox Sportsnet Chicago. From a stadium perspective, Wrigley Field opened in 1914, but every game before August 8, 1988 was played during the day as the stadium was initially built without lights. The team almost left Wrigley over the fight and the battle to get lights added to the stadium. The first game was hosted by Harry Carey and joined by comedian Bill Murray and broadcast on WGN-TV. We just overhauled the lights at Wrigley in 2022, this past offseason, to modernize them to sort of standard LED lights that are common at most stadiums. I will say it was pretty wild sitting in our office looking over and watching a helicopter rise up above the skyline of the stadium as they were transporting the old lights out and bringing the new lights in. It was pretty wild. On the ownership front, Tribune Company acquired the team in 1981 after a player strike for the total sum of about $21 million. This picture here is from right before we kicked off the 1060 project, and is generally illustrative of the neighborhood during the Tribune ownership. In the foreground, you can see Clark Street. There's a bunch of empty parking lots. There's a famous McDonald's that residents of the neighborhood loved. In general, there was not a ton going on in the neighborhood. Along the outfield side on Sheffield and Wayland Avenue, you can see a bunch of the rooftops that all have great sight lines into the stadium. However, those businesses were operated completely separate from our business. The Tribune, for their part, they were mostly focused on things other than baseball. They're a publicly traded company. Success for them was measured by TV and print circulation for their publications and advertising revenue. I think the Cubs, in a lot of ways, were viewed as cheap and consistent content to populate WGN-TV, the WGN Superstation, and WGN Radio. I think, and obviously wasn't there, but I think the general goal was to open the gates, try to not lose any money, and then reinvest any incremental profits that were created back into the core business. The Tribune probably had a successful flywheel at some point, but that flywheel almost certainly did not revolve around building sustainable success for the Chicago Cubs. Tribune ultimately went bankrupt in 2008 in the recession, rising interest rates, challenges in the print media industry. So it's probably not surprising that with that backdrop, the state of the organization was in a bit of disarray when the Ricketts family acquired the team in 2009. This slide summarizes most of those challenges, and we could spend days, if not weeks, sort of diving into each one of these, but to quickly highlight some of the key themes. Ballpark hadn't been touched in a very long time. I know there's an entire session dedicated to the restoration of Wrigley later this week, so I won't belabor this point. But many of the steel columns in the stadium had completely rotted through. Many of the beams that held up the upper deck had completely fallen off their foundation. The stadium was literally crumbling. The picture before showed the neighborhood hadn't really been touched. But beyond that, pretty much everywhere you looked, people were stealing the organization's intellectual property. I mentioned the rooftops who were actively competing with us, marketing literally the same product across the street from the stadium. We had a bunch of neighborhood merchandise shops selling unlicensed merch and generally operating businesses kind of outside the normal rules of baseball. StubHub, Ticket Scalpers, there are a ton of these small mom and pop organizations who are profiting handsomely off of our product. You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about ticket pricing. At the time, they were much better at pricing their tickets than the Chicago Cubs front office were. And probably more importantly, these ticket brokers and the people operating in that system were interjecting or intermediating, putting themselves between us as the organization and our customer. To go back to Amazon, the Amazon example, right? Amazon has been so successful because they learn identifiable information about you, and then they sort of customize that experience to you. When you're buying a ticket on the street corner, we as the Chicago Cubs have no idea who you are, what's important to you, why you're coming to Wrigley, or how we can make your experience better. We had some real challenges on the tax and sort of the city side. And internally, the infrastructure was a mess. We had the smallest front office in baseball. Our technology infrastructure was either non-existent or a bit of a disaster. And as I mentioned, we had no idea who our customers were. There are many amusing anecdotes about the poor state of the Chicago Cubs business infrastructure from this time. The one that probably hits closest to home for me was the state of our data center. I call it a data center, but I'm pretty sure it was a single rack, if not a single computer, that sat in the basement of Wrigley. As a 100-plus-year-old stadium, Wrigley had several leaks, both when it would rain and when we would power wash to clean the seats. And that's a real risk. That is a critical business risk when your one computer is sitting under a leak in the basement of your stadium. Being the ever-resourceful group that we were at the time, the IT team constructed this tarp. They affectionately named it the Rain Hat. And then there was this entire maintenance schedule to make sure the rain hat was properly oriented, given if there was rain in the forecast, we're going to power wash because that would be a different leak. And that's just like generally how the business ran for decades. At the same time, we also took ticket orders on triplicate carbon paper and generally hoped and prayed that one would make it to accounting, one would make it to the ticket office group, and then one would make it to like filing, you know, for good record keeping purposes. So suffice to say, a sophisticated business juggernaut, we were not. So, in summary, when the Ricketts family acquired the team, pretty much everything was broken. On the upside, things were broken to the point that the problems were pretty obvious, and the solutions were also things that we could wrap our heads around. We weren't naive enough, however, to think that addressing those problems would be easy. In addition to the breadth of challenges that the organization faced, there was a whole bunch of well-connected, well-financed third parties and other groups kind of in our ecosystem who had been profiting handsomely off of the state of the way things were. All of them had a vested interest in watching us fail. Do you want to dive in a little bit on the top left corner and talk a little bit more about our major league roster and kind of state of the core business at the time? I think as everyone knows, the Cubs had developed the moniker the Lovable Losers. This was in large part due to the somewhat erratic nature of the on-field product. I grabbed our win percentage going back to 1995, and the thing that stands out to me is a somewhat quick sort of oscillations between periods of winning, periods of losing. It's not entirely clear to me if there's significant rhyme or reason to why this line bounces around the way that it does. And that's put into more contrast, stark contrast, when you compare win percentage from the Chicago Cubs over that time to our NL Central rival in the Cardinals. Right? As a data analyst, someone who looks at data, looks at graphs, looks at charts, try to understand them for a living, I look at this and I just ask, why? Like, what were the Cardinals doing? What was their flywheel? How were they running their business that made them so much more successful when you look at win percentage compared to the Chicago Cubs organization? Well, our roster was old, and we had very little talent coming up through our minor league ranks. In fact, this is actually a byproduct of a very intentional strategy from the previous ownership group to rely pretty heavily on free agency to construct that roster. I think, as everyone knows, or most people may agree, there's generally an inverse relationship between player age and sustained on-field productivity. Long story short, we were investing in the wrong side of that equation. Constructing a roster via free agency is also pretty expensive, sometimes prohibitively expensive. The Cubs were outspending our NL Central counterparts to the tune of $40 to $60 million per year, but we weren't seeing the on-field success that should come with those investments. And as a result, the win efficiency, or the amount of money that we were having to invest per win, was significantly higher than all of our competition. In short, we were not a very efficient organization. The other byproduct of that intentional strategy to rely on free agency is that we had not built the organizational muscle to identify or develop talent through our minor leagues. The stats from 2003 to 2011, the Chicago Cubs draft picks generated the fewest WAR out of all 30 clubs. I think it's somewhat easy to Monday morning quarterback the decisions of past organizations, but I did go pull some of the players that were on the board when we made our draft picks, and we notably missed on players like Nick Markakis, Jacoby Ellsbury, Clay Buchholz, Jason Kipnis, Christian Yelich, and the list goes on and on and on from players who have now gone on to have very successful major league careers while we were investing in talent that most of those guys never made it past double A. It is a very hard game, but nonetheless, we were not doing what we needed to do to develop talent within our own organization. Taken together, it's easy to see why this was not a sustainable flywheel-inducing strategy. This slide shows that age versus performance dichotomy that I talked about. And in 2011, we had six players on the roster over the age of 30, taking down a combined $103 million in salary. They contributed a total of about five wins above replacement that year. Contrast that with the 2016 roster, 17 players under the age of 30. I didn't go track down all of the wins above replacement for this group of players, but suffice to say, you win the World Series, and I think they were pretty effective at what we were trying to do. On a personal note, there's some interesting symmetry here. My wife and I first visited Chicago in 2011. We actually stayed in this hotel, and actually might have been in a conference in this room. We didn't have tickets to the Cubs on that trip, but we went up to Wrigley to take in the sights and sounds. We're hanging out at a bar on Clark Street, ended up getting free tickets from a bartender, quite literally just giving our product away. This was like middle of the summer, playing the Cardinals, should have been a marquee matchup, and tickets were just floating around for free. Fast forward 5 years, October of 2016, when I was able to join the front office, and 30 days later, we'd go on to win the World Series. As a resident stats guy in the office, I'm careful not to mix correlation and causation. However, I will say, we hired me, and then 30 days later, we won the World Series. I am quick to remind all of my colleagues of this anytime any of them will listen. Further to that point, my wife had actually interned for the Red Sox in 2004, and so maybe it's not Theo that is the common link there, but actually my wife. So again, I'm just gonna plant that seed. So lest anyone tell you that the 2016 Cubs were an overnight success, the final tally showed that there were 140 players, 37 trades, 80 signings, and 85 departures that led to that 2016 roster. I hope you don't take that I or we as the Chicago Cubs are sort of anti-free agency. That's a fantastic way to complement and supplement your roster. And in fact, we did so pretty successfully in that 2016 season. See the players on the bottom of the slide that we added that season either through free agency or trade, including MVP that season, Ben Zobrist. So while Theo and Baseball Ops were busy running out that playbook, we were focused on overhauling our physical infrastructure. Two goals here. The first one, and I think this should be pretty obvious, we wanted and we needed to provide best-in-class facilities for our players. But the second was more about culture. It's hard to expect first-class performance and first-class productivity when providing substandard playing facilities for your staff. If we're going to overhaul that organizational culture, which, like it or not, as I said before, was directly tied to being the lovable losers, we had to go top to bottom. Started with about a $100 million investment into what is now called Sloan Park, opened our performance center there in 2014, and at the same time we built an academy down in the Dominican, opened in 2013. These two investments completely overhauled the player development infrastructure and what we're able to do to take young and upcoming talent and get them ready to compete at the major league level. Touch a little bit on Wrigley. Again, I don't want to go too deep here, but suffice to say, overhauling Wrigley Field was the most ambitious project that we undertook. By the stats, 5 years, $760 million renovation, complete and total gut rehab. Today, it's basically a brand new stadium, sort of from a mechanicals perspective. We did make the curious decision to do this during the off seasons, during the mild, gentle Chicago winters. Hindsight, that may have not been the best choice, but we did not want to deprive Chicago fans of the ability to watch games at Wrigley Field. So at the end of that 5-year investment, we now have brand new player facilities with a 30,000 square foot clubhouse, 40% increase in bathrooms and concession points of sale, 4 new clubs and over 1,400 new premium and high value seats, brand new renovated luxury suite level, and new video boards and some other sort of assets that help us on the business side. We also saw an opportunity to expand outside of Wrigley Field. So if we go back to that picture 4 or 5 slides back, it was a really relatively barren campus. We wanted to expand deeper into the Wrigleyville neighborhood. Part of this was offensive and part of it was defensive. On the offensive side, we saw an opportunity to capture a greater share or percentage of the Wrigleyville economy. On the other hand, it was a hedge against team performance, going back to the sort of the sine curve of minimizing the lows and maximizing the highs. No longer were we solely an 81-day-per-year organization focused just on Chicago Cubs baseball, but we saw an opportunity to add some family and community assets to the neighborhood. In 2011, we bought that McDonald's and the parking lot surrounding it. In 2015, we kicked off a roughly $250 million mixed-use development that is now known as Gallagher Way. We built our office building, and then on the left-hand side of this picture, you see what is now Hotel Zachary. I don't know if you can see it, but in the bottom left corner, you can see the McDonald's logo mixed amongst our Christmas decor. So for those residents in the Wrigleyville neighborhood who needed their McDonald's, it is still there. Summarizing a lot, but suffice to say, the first decade of Ricketts family ownership was primarily focused on two things. One, overhauling the physical infrastructure, and two, overhauling our player development and pipeline. Moving forward, the next focus is going to be much more on our digital infrastructure. I think we've come a long way from that rain hat. We're ingesting hundreds of data streams about our customers, but we still have a lot of work to set the team up, set the business up for success. This is where I spend the majority of my time building and leading our business analytics team. At its core, business is pretty simple. We host live events, we sell tickets, food, beverage, merchandise. Then we make that content available on TV, radio, and more streaming platforms. We With the shift towards more digital interactions between brands and consumers, somewhat accelerated by COVID-19, we're generating significantly more data about each and every one of us and how you want to engage with us as the Cubs. And so we're spending a lot of time trying to find new ways to thoughtfully bundle or package these different products in ways that feel natural to you as consumers. Again, I'd go back, look at Amazon, look at Nike, look at Sephora, look at all these best-in-class businesses and how you interact with them. We're trying to make some efforts to close that gap between how we run our business and how they've been operating those businesses for decades at this point. It's a good transition, I think, talking about digital interactions. I do want to talk for a couple minutes about COVID-19 and how we navigated that. To say that COVID-19 was disruptive to our business and the world would be the understatement of the century. But I would say I'd highlight a couple things. And unlike 2009, when pretty quickly we were able to articulate and put that playbook together of what needed to be done, we didn't have a playbook to help navigate COVID-19. Having said that, we did mobilize pretty quickly and align behind these four pillars. We came to the view pretty quickly that our business was going to come to a screeching halt, and we had to develop the ability to pivot. You know, I gave the quick history of the Chicago Cubs from 1876 to 2009. In general, change takes a long time in baseball. COVID forced us to tighten that cycle significantly. We knew the world was going to change, but we didn't know how. So I personally, me and my team, we spent a bunch of time helping, trying to build analytical models, analytical frameworks that we could understand what would happen to our business, how could we best position ourselves for success, and how could we package that information in a way that was consumable by our leadership. I've been in the analytics space for 15 years, and if I've learned anything, it's that executive leaders in general are somewhat averse to uncertainty, and so trying to give them things like, here is a range of outcomes, can sometimes be a tough thing. It's like, right, what's the number? What's gonna happen? The reality is we didn't know, right? Are we gonna be able to host games? Maybe, maybe not. Are we gonna be able to host games with fans? Maybe, maybe not. Are we gonna have a limited capacity? There's so much that was unknown, and we had no idea. Nonetheless, we kind of trudged on. One of the things I'm pretty proud of from that COVID season is that we took the time back. Since we're not hosting fans inside Wrigley Field, we had a whole bunch of our executive leadership team that weren't sort of heads down running day-to-day business. And we essentially went to them and we said, go imagine your business in 5 years. What do you want that to look like? What can you do to pull that 5-year vision forward to today? We did a bunch of things coming out of that strategic planning cycle, and I want to highlight a couple that really overhauled the game day experience. First, simply getting inside Wrigley Field. This may seem like a small thing, but if I told you that on a busy summer Saturday in 2019 or years prior, you'd spend 25, maybe up to 30 minutes simply waiting to get inside Wrigley Field. Not quite as bad as TSA without pre-check, but not much better. Through a mix of technology and sort of operational changes, we've all but eliminated wait times getting inside Wrigley Field. Back to my point about the flywheel, finding ways for us to remove fan friction often leads to greater fan satisfaction. That has some virtuous benefits for us as a business. Second, the next longest line you would typically stand in when you came to Wrigley Field was trying to get a hot dog and a soda. This is an area as a business or as an industry, there's a whole bunch of really smart upcoming companies. So we took 2021 and first half of 2022, we ran a bunch of small-scale pilots. I called it the Hunger Games of Wrigley Field, where we basically invited, come one, come all, bring your best technology, let's see how we can improve the guest experience. Ultimately, aligned behind one of these companies, we now have about 40 of these self-checkout units scattered across the stadium. Again, wait time went from somewhere 15 to 20 minutes to simply get a hot dog and a soda to now 2 to 3 minutes. Significant improvement in the game day experience. I also fully recognize the third longest line you may wait in would be access to a restroom. That one, still haven't figured out, but the reality is sometimes you can't escape trying to host 40,000 people in a stadium that was built over 100 years ago. Taken in isolation, Neither of these improvements may seem terribly revolutionary, and that may be true. However, it's a constant evaluation, and it's finding areas to improve our business that we are spending our time focused on. All right, we're almost ready to wrap up, so I wanted to come back to this notion of stewardship. Out of all the areas where we focus, this is the one that probably resonates most deeply with me. In a variety of ways, baseball has been a big part of my life since I was 4 years old. You know, baseball as a game and as a business helps close gaps across time, generation, and geography. We're a global game and we bring people and cultures together. Stewardship done well is action-oriented. I would point to the recent MLB rule changes that we implemented this year as an example of being active stewards, right? Game times are down, balls in play are up, fan satisfaction and attendance are also up. Those are all really good things. I hope that we, working in the industry and you sitting where you are, take that and feel somewhat emboldened to push for future change so that we can all improve the product that is the game of baseball. I'd also point back to all the investments that we made into our physical infrastructure as a good example of active stewardship. We're trying to focus on building things that will stand the test of time. The last sentence on this slide, which I don't know if you can see, but it says, honoring our past as we build our future, I think summarizes it well. After we won the World Series, there is this organic outpouring of love and emotion that found its way onto the brick of Wrigley Field in the form of these tributes and memorials, paying honor and homage to family members and friends who may not have been able to be there to witness that historic event. It's a good reminder to me of how powerful this game is and how we all have the ability to shape it moving forward. I think in many ways, this organization has been both a steward and a vanguard for the game of baseball. The entirety of baseball analytics is quite literally a byproduct of this group, right? It is called Sabre Analytics for a reason. So as you go through this convention, I hope you feel energized to share ideas, find new friends, rekindle relationships with old friends, learn from one another, and also challenge one another. You can impact the game in ways small and large, and I'm excited to see what you come up with. Thank you. So I think we got some time for questions.
Hi, thanks for the talk, very good talk. So do you happen to have any input into the content of the video boards, or is that beyond the scope of your responsibility?
That is a little, so the question is about content on the video boards. That is not directly within my purview on the strategy team. However, we do sort of oversee that and sort of guide with our marketing communications team.
Okay, well, all right, so, you know, where I'm going with this is, so I, as a season ticket holder, you know, I loved seeing the video board come in. It was a great upgrade. I think it was 2015, and it was, you know, a very good board for its time. It's the ninth year now, and the board is essentially exactly the same information, exactly the same look and feel and all, whereas when I go to other ballparks, I see other ballparks really upgrading, you know, the boards themselves and the information they give and the look. The Southside Ballpark, for instance, has a great looking board with a lot of good information. So I was just wondering if there is any discussion that they might do that to the Wrigley video board, or is it a business decision that they make? You know, our fan base appreciates, they appreciate the. You know, the nostalgia, the feel, the look and feel, and that they don't really like that kind of change. And I just wonder if that's ever been discussed.
Yeah, it's a totally fair question. I'd say, broadly speaking, we'll evaluate, you know, we've made significant investment into the stadium, and over time we know we'll need to make additional investments. So I would put updates or sort of modernization of the video board in line with that. Mm-hmm. The other thing I sort of highlight is not solely a business decision. We have as a nationally registered historical landmark. There's some other sort of constraints that we have to navigate. But broadly speaking, I don't think there's a timeline, or at least not one that I'm aware of. But you know, we're we're going to continue to invest in Wrigley Field moving forward, and updating the video board is certainly within that purview.
Okay, well, I vote yes and prove it. Thanks.
Yeah, one spoke of your flywheel was reinvestment, and you had a young core from 2016 and didn't reinvest in any of them.
Sorry?
You had a young core in 2016 and you have not reinvested in any of them. I'm talking about player development.
That's, I do think we've got some significant talent coming up in the pipeline. You know, we need to see some of those guys kind of matriculate and start to contribute, but it's a fair point.
If you concentrate, though, on developing young players, you're going to end up with the same sort of graph you had in the Tribune era, up and down, up and down, up and down.
Hopefully not.
Yeah, this is also about player performance. Right now, a traditional fan, which this room is full of, could easily be looking forward to a great World Series between Atlanta and Tampa. But we also know that statistically that isn't very likely because of three rounds of playoffs. And we've seen many times when the clearly statistically superior team in the league didn't make the World Series. We've also seen that it's possible for a team that really isn't that good to win three World Series in 6 years, the San Francisco Giants. My question is, facts, man, facts. My question is, do you think that problem is creating a disincentive to try to create and maintain a team that is significantly superior to a team that can simply make the playoffs?
It's a really good question. I think across your 30 baseball operations and ownership groups, I don't think there's one prevailing viewpoint on that. I do think, Ray, we did recently expand the playoffs, change that dynamic and that incentive structure a little bit. And I would say that sort of the question you raised here was at the heart of what do we think will happen when some of those changes are implemented. Candidly, I think time will tell as baseball operations groups sort of optimize against whatever strategy their ownership or they come up with internally. But I don't think you'll see kind of one globally true answer across all 30 clubs. It's a really good question.
Thank you.
Hi. You characterized, as we were listening to you talk about the rooftop seating across the street from Wrigley Field, you characterized what was going on in Wrigley as kind of the team's intellectual property. And I wonder if you could expand upon that a little bit, especially considering that the events that happen on the ball field, hits, runs, errors, that stuff is publicly available data that runs in newspapers and on fantasy sites and everything like that. What is that distinction? Because it's an open air ballpark that technically things are happening in that people should conceivably be able to see into if they have a property that overlooks that.
Yeah, it's a totally fair question. I think highlighted probably most acutely by the rooftops. But I think that the general view of the thesis was that, right, like we, as the Chicago Cubs, bear the sort of the cost and the energy and make a bunch of investments to make the gameplay happen. And so at the time, there were a bunch of properties, you know, the rooftops, some of the merchandise shops, et cetera, that were not basically cordial or did not necessarily acknowledge the costs that we had made. And, you know, as for the Ricketts family, when they came in to acquire the team, it was in their best interest to better align those incentives across all of those properties, because there was significant value that was sort of leaving the ecosystem and going to these other third parties. And so that was more the investment, right? If you put your investor hat on, there's this notion or belief that if you could better align those incentives, then sort of reinforce that flywheel.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, we've all heard of the demise of RSNs, and the Cubs are introducing their direct-to-consumer model here pretty soon. My question is, do you think this will eventually have a negative effect on how much teams can spend on free agents and stuff like this direct-to-consumer model? And everybody's saying this is the future. I'm just wondering if you think it'll eventually affect payrolls.
Yeah, it's a good, so the question is about sort of RSNs and the way that media rights in baseball work today. You know, I think a couple things are true. People, fans, consumers really want to watch live sports content. That is true. Advertisers are happy to pay to put ads in front of sports fans watching content. I think the RSN model as it currently exists is going to experience some disruption. I mean, there's two bankruptcies that are unfolding in the court system right now, and you're seeing kind of shuffling of rights go between RSN operator and maybe reverting back to MLB central office. So I do think there's going to be some disruption. Like, that is, open the Wall Street Journal every other day and there's an update. My perspective is I think it's going to take a little bit of time for all that to sort out. I do not expect significant long-term disruption there. There's going to be some short-term sort of pain. But like I said, I think, you know, fans, consumers, we all still like live sports content, and likely as an industry, we need to kind of update how we modernize and sort of distribute that product as the RSN model is not, you know, terribly viable moving forward, sort of broadly speaking. But I don't expect significant sort of long-term disruption.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi there, thank you for being here, first of all. I'd like to ask like a sort of two-part question. One, in terms of player development, what were the intangibles about the 16 Cubs that separated them from other previously talented teams like the 69 Cubs with all the Hall of Famers or the 84 team? And I think related to that is the matter of, in the follow-up to that, did the Cubs keep their core together too long the way I think the Phillies did, sorry, Mark, after the 2008-09 success that the Phillies had? And I like those calculus-looking graphs. I'm a math guy. But I'm wondering if you could comment on that in terms of, for a team to be successful, how do they build up to that point of success? And then if they keep their core together too long, as I think the Cubs probably did, then what are the ramifications of that? And also, the second point I'd like to make is in terms of, you've mentioned investing, do the Cubs talk about socially responsible investing? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for both questions. On the first one, candidly, that's probably a better question for Theo or Jed and Carter. You know, I'd sort of my take from being a fan and kind of an avid consumer of our game. I think if you look at that 2016 roster, you had a couple things that congealed all at one time. One, we had some really young players that, frankly, probably outperformed expectations for where they should contribute. And they also just had a really good clubhouse vibe, right? They played loose, and I do think there's something intangible in kind of the relationships and the way that team went about their business. To the question on do we keep the core around too long, that's a really good question. Makes for fantastic banter in forums like this and in the press. You know, I think we're very happy to have assembled that crew and put together a pretty good run from 2015 really through 2019. But yeah, we could debate that one for quite a while, I think. The question on sort of social investing and social responsibility, it is a somewhat broad question. So I'm not sure my head kind of goes in a couple ways. You know, I would say a couple elements where we're spending a ton of time and energy. One, I'd almost go back to being a good neighbor. You know, we have an entire dedicated charity arm in the form of Cubs Charities that's investing in our local communities. We also spend a ton of time thinking about sort of waste and the products that we create as Wrigley Field and how can we be more sustainable in those endeavors, right? Hosting 40,000 fans at Wrigley Field 81 times a year creates a lot of stuff. And so thoughtfully disposing of that is a big focus for the organization. But those are a couple of my initial thoughts that you may have been going in a different direction. So let's catch up after this if I missed the mark there.
Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Carpenter. I really like the last slide about stewardship, honoring the past as we create our future. In my opinion, there is an opportunity to honor the past, which is, and bring back an alienated segment of the fan base, which would be all Sammy Sosa fans. And this is a wonderful opportunity to honor the past, right? No one represented the soul of the Cubs more, or one of the three players that represented the soul of the Cubs, like Sammy. And as we move into the future with all, like, the marquee network and the gambling, where what the Cubs used to mean gets obscured by larger business interests, why not reach back to something that needs to be someone and whose legacy needs to be taken care of? Because if the Cubs don't do it, who's going to take care of this legacy?
Totally fair question. Not the first time we've received that question or suggestion as an organization, and candidly, that one's going to roll up to our executive leadership and ownership team. But duly noted.
Hi. In looking at your business slides, I noted that you didn't discuss at all revenue from gambling and sportsbook. Can you tell me projected 5 years now, what percentage of the club, or if you, that's proprietary baseball revenue, will be from sports and gambling? And what sort of controls for the integrity of the game do the Cubs and baseball have to protect the game?
Yeah, sort of two-part question there. So I didn't mention it here, but we are launching a sports book immediately adjacent to Wrigley Field. It actually opened last week, and that license will come in a couple weeks. I think I'll punt a little bit on sort of the revenue forecast for that. Like, the reality is sports wagering in the United States is very new, and even more so in the state of Illinois. Sort of controls in the integrity of the game. This, broadly speaking, has been on the roadmap of Major League Baseball and all 30 clubs for a very long time. When you think about sort of the incentive structures and what you need from a technology and sort of integrity standpoint, both for your players and then sort of personnel who may have access to sensitive information. What I can say is we've, in baseball and at the Cubs, we're trying to follow sort of best in class guidelines of, because other sports leagues, and particularly outside the US, have gone down this path before us. And, you know, time will tell once our sports book opens and operates, but I do feel confident that we've got the right controls in place to sort of maintain the integrity of the game.
What are your thoughts about now that baseball is going to a somewhat balanced schedule, and that you have divisions like the American League East and the National League East and all that, where teams are really good, the Red Sox are really good and all that, and yet you have Central Division, sorry that you're in the Central Division, and that in the American League is even worse. The team that's leading the American League Central, I think, is what, 500 at best, and you know that if you just stacked the teams in terms of wins and losses in each league, you wouldn't have quite the same teams in the playoffs. What are your thoughts? Will baseball ever deal with that, or will they always keep the small market teams together in the central divisions? And you're not a small market team, obviously, and the Cardinals aren't really a small market team, but everybody else, the other eight teams are, and will they do that together so that it gives the small market teams a chance to get into the playoffs? Or will baseball look at it and say, hey, you know, it's kind of unfair that the American League East is playing at a 600 winning percentage, and only four of those teams can make the playoffs?
Yeah, really good question. I think part of it, I think, is an issue of sort of timeline and perspective, and certainly the way that we're watching competitiveness unfold this year would very much falls in line with what you commented. Over time, you may see that, may see some of those dynamic shifts. You also highlight, in baseball, we have some pretty thoughtful mechanisms in place to try and balance the competitiveness via revenue sharing and some other player development sort of levers to help balance that score a little bit. I don't think any of that stuff is set in stone. So both at MLB Central Office in New York and then through the various committees that the ownership groups sit on, this is a question that is kind of at the core of the longevity of the game. And I sort of go back to the stewardship point. I don't know if anything is sort of imminently on the horizon, but sort of maintaining the health and competitive balance across all 30 clubs and how we currently have them divvied up is a sort of constant topic of conversation. For me personally, I'm super excited to have Shohei Ohtani come at least once every other year. I keep trying to like interject into the atmosphere that we need to sign him as the Cubs. Not sure we'll see where that shakes out, but I do think the balanced schedule has created some more interesting matchups. And it's been exciting to see teams come into town sort of more frequently. So I'm personally excited for that.
I noticed that the graph of Cubs success was cyclical, but the period of low before the period of high was unusually long and unusually sustained and usually bad. So it's sort of a what did you know and when did you know it question, okay? So one word answers yes and no or all out, but I hope you'll comment, okay? Was this deliberate, like it was with the Astros, where they deliberately were switching over to younger development players and therefore knew they were going to be lousy? And was that discussed with you when you arrived within your first year or so, having joined the team, because you joined it at the height of success?
So first question, yes. I'd also caveat that was a very highly stylized graph, so I wouldn't necessarily tie that back to any specific point in time. And I'd say within our business operations, we are pretty distinct and separate from baseball operations. Certainly at the ownership level, we get some sort of insight and sort of longer term forecast because team competitiveness has direct impacts on us on the business side. But by and large, and you know, this is kind of the fundamental contrast between business versus baseball. On the baseball side, it's very much a zero sum game where any information or any piece of intelligence can pretty much only adversely impact you. We don't have that dynamic on the business side, so I have very collegial and open relationships with basically all of my counterparts, but on the baseball side, they keep pretty much all that very close to their vest. So we're getting close to time, so then we got time for one more question, and then we'll wrap up.
As the president of the Wisconsin chapter, as a Brewer fan, and coming from a city where many of the Brewer fans' second favorite team is who's ever playing the Cubs. And nothing probably makes many of us happier than seeing the L flag flying over the stadium. I'm really not here to pick on the Cubs. I'm going to start with an offhanded compliment, but I'm hopefully the thank you comes through on that. Up in Milwaukee, we all fondly talk about game 163. I'm not sure what you guys call that here in Chicago, but we love that game. And I had the pleasure of going to the friendly confines, and a friend of mine that went with us, we were sitting upstairs with vertigo, he could not walk down to our seats. So he was going to stand up at the aisle there and just watch from there. The usher there was so concerned that he was not sitting in a comfortable seat that he paid for. She got hold of someone and said, can we find a seat downstairs where they can sit so he doesn't have to watch from standing? And the usher staff went and found us seats 8 rows off the field, just into the left field, didn't charge us for that, so he could have a seat. The usher cared enough about them. When we left, the ushers were saying to Brewer fans, thanks for coming, hope to see you next year, congratulations. The ushers were friendly. When, you know, having gone to Milwaukee County Stadium forever, and then Miller Park and AmFam, I've never said the ushers are ever friendly. I've never felt that. And so I was really impressed that we were actually welcomed, and the part of what you're saying, the friendliness of the ballpark, you're very successful at that. So thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. I don't think I can top that. Like I said, you know, the friendly confines truly are for everyone. So thank you for sharing that story. I hope those words are not sort of meaningless, and it's stories and anecdotes like that that really bring it to life. So With that, I think we'll wrap things up this morning. So thank you again. Have a great convention.